Hello and welcome to Science World. The World Wide Web, the Internet, one of the most valuable and important information resources, celebrated its 25th anniversary this past week. As we celebrate the World Wide Web's silver anniversary, a new report says that Facebook may soon be a step closer to bringing Internet access to the entire world. This past week, a group of young scientists came to Washington to compete for the top prize of $100,000 in the Intel Science Talent Search. And the classic equation, E equals mc squared, is part of Albert Einstein's special theory of relativity that was published in 1905. 10 years later, in 1915, he published his general theory of relativity. Have you ever wondered what these two scientific theories are all about and why, after 100 years, the science community still considers them to be so incredibly important? A scientist who just wrote a book on Einstein and his theories of relativity joins us today on our one-on-one segment to explain. This and much more are coming your way on VOA Science, Health, and Technology magazine, Science World. This past Wednesday marked the 25th anniversary of the invention of the World Wide Web. As David Byrd reports, what started as a way for scientists to share research has changed life throughout the world forever.
In March of 1989, British scientist Tim Berners-Lee was working at the European Organization for Nuclear Research, or CERN, in Switzerland. Scientists would come to CERN from all over the world, but others could not view their research because their computers were not compatible. Berners-Lee thought it would be easier if all the computers could talk to one another and swap information directly. So he proposed a way of linking the machines. The response from his bosses to his proposal, titled Information Management a Proposal? Vague, but exciting. Little did they know. Berners-Lee's proposal would later become known as the World Wide Web. It took almost 2 years before he and a colleague could successfully link a computer server and a web browser through the Internet. It would be August of 1991 before the web was officially launched. By 1993, there were more than 500 web servers. Now there are more than 1.7 billion people on the web worldwide. James Hendler is the director of the Rensselaer Institute for Data Exploration and Applications in Troy, New York. Speaking by Skype, he said one of the main challenges to web growth, the English coding and keyboard, has been solved, and Asia can look for an explosion of web access.
In China right now, I saw a recent graphic that says 6 out of the 10 largest social networking sites like Facebook, are in China. Most people don't realize that the second largest search company is Baidu, which is the Chinese search company. So we really are seeing most of the, in the U.S., we're at somewhere between 80% and 90% of people already having access, and, you know, not much growth. In China, you see about 25%, and of course, a country much bigger than ours. India, I don't know the current number, but again, a small number growing very quickly. So most of the growth we expect in the web will actually be in those parts of the world that don't yet have it.
Hendler has worked on the web since its early days and has co-authored several papers with Tim Berners-Lee. Paul Levinson is a professor of communication and media studies at Fordham University. Speaking by Skype, he said events such as the Arab Spring and the Occupy Wall Street movement showed the power that the web has put in the hands of everyday people. With billions of people able to access information, some countries have tried to limit or control web access. But Levinson says governments need to realize that the web is a tool that is unrivaled in its reach and influence.
What we have now is a battle. On the one hand, the governments are more aware of these devices, and they are more aware of what used to be called and still could be called citizen journalism. But on the other hand, there are more smartphones out there than ever before. And I think so far, and this is good for democracy and the expression of human ideas, so far the people are winning.
James Hendler says that even 25 years after its invention, only a fraction of the web's potential has been realized. Tim Berners-Lee went on to found the World Wide Web Foundation, which has as part of its mission statement that it wants to establish the open web as a global public good and a basic right. In Washington, I'm David Byrd, VOA News.
Researchers have developed a vaginal gel that is effective in protecting monkeys from infection with an AIDS-like virus. The main potential advantage of the microbicide for humans is that it can be applied by women even up to several hours after intercourse. Jessica Berman has more.
The vaginal gel was 84% effective in shielding a group of female rhesus macaques from infection with SHIV, a hybrid of HIV and the primate version of the virus. Four of the six monkeys treated with the gel up to 3 hours after exposure were protected against the virus, while all macaques in the placebo group became infected. The study reported in the journal Science Translational Medicine is the first to demonstrate the effectiveness of a microbicide following sexual intercourse. Waleed Hanaini of the Division of HIV/AIDS Prevention at the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention was one of the lead investigators. He says the experimental compound, which contains the anti-HIV drug raltegravir, works by blocking the virus from integrating itself into cells and replicating after it enters the body.
And we showed that this step takes more than 6 hours, and therefore there is provides ample time for dosing or for treatment with the gel vaginally. And we showed in the CAC model that this modality works and protects animals from infection.
His team also found that the monkeys were protected from SHIV when the gel was used a half hour before exposure to the virus. Before starting clinical trials, researchers need to confirm that the microbicide would offer similar protection against HIV in humans. If it does, say experts, it could put women in better control of their health. According to Melissa Robiani, director of biomedical HIV research at the Population Council in New York, women would not have to negotiate with their partners about protection against the deadly virus.
Pre-treatment or pre-dosing of a product, in this case a gel, presumably is more cumbersome to the woman, and maybe a post-exposure regimen, as is suggested from these studies, would be more acceptable because they would potentially be able to do it in the absence of their partner knowing.
Gauging the microbicide's acceptance and ease of use will be an important part of the clinical trials once they begin. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
Coming up in a few minutes, we'll hear about Albert Einstein's theories of relativity. So with those important theories in mind, it's time for this week's Science World Quick Quiz. Now, almost everybody has heard what has to be one of the most famous science equations ever, E equals mc squared. What we want to know from the following, what does the C in that equation stand for? Is it A, the speed of light in a vacuum, B, the total mass of the universe, or C, the distance between the Earth and Sun? Good luck. We'll give you the correct answer in just a few minutes from now.
You're listening to Science World, VOA Science, Health, and Technology News Magazine.
A media report says that Facebook may soon make a major step in its goal of bringing internet access to the entire world. Science World's Bob Doty has more.
A Reuters news agency report says Facebook is in negotiations to buy New Mexico-based drone manufacturer Titan Aerospace for $60 million to use pilotless aircraft as transmitters of Wi-Fi internet signals. Last year, Facebook, together with technology giants including Nokia, Ericsson, and Samsung, founded a group called Internet.org, aimed at making internet available to people everywhere in the world. Facebook will have competition from Google, which also plans to bring cheap internet access to remote parts of the world using stratospheric balloons. It looks like the two internet giants are in a bit of a race, says CNET Editor-in-Chief of Technology, Lindsay Turrentine.
You know, Google's been working on this for a little while, so it'll be interesting to see who covers more ground, you know, literally and figuratively, first.
So far, Titan Aerospace tested only a small prototype of its solar-powered drones, but claims they will be able to carry a payload of up to 113 kilograms and stay in the air for up to 5 years, flying at an altitude of around 20 kilometers, well above commercial airspace. Google started testing its technology last June in New Zealand, and tests continue in California's Central Valley. Its balloons are also solar-powered and will be able to create a network similar to the network of satellites in the Global Positioning System. While Google is well advanced in developing its balloon technology, Facebook has yet to announce its first tests. For Science World, I'm Bob Doty.
Scientists from the University of Chicago say they have found what they believe is the gene strongly linked to obesity. The study, published in the journal Nature, shows that mice bred without the IRX3 gene were 30% lighter than mice bred with the gene. Both groups of mice ate the same diet and exercised the same way, but the thin mice were found to be resistant to diabetes and burned energy more efficiently. The researchers say there is a similar gene in humans and that their findings could lead to a drug to treat obesity and diabetes. Washington recently hosted the finalists in an annual competition for young scientists. George Putich talked with three of those young scientists.
1 year ago, 1,794 American high school students submitted research projects to the Intel Science Talent Search. This week, the top 40 students came to Washington to compete for the top prize of $100,000. Each of them presented a solution to a single difficult problem, from cancer and mathematics to ecology. Kevin Lee from Irvine, California, developed a mathematical model for correlating electrical signals from the heart with cardiac arrhythmia, which he hopes will contribute to better understanding of this sometimes fatal condition.
If we can design a drug that's better in that it's based off of an improved understanding of what's going on in the heart, then we can reduce side effects and make better drugs.
Kevin went on to win the second prize of $75,000. Angela Kong, a 17-year-old senior from San Jose, California, looked at so-called cancer stem cells that successfully evade treatment.
What underlying mechanisms cause these stem cells to go into a stage of inactivity so we can better target them with the drugs that we have today, and in terms of long-term implications to potentially target breast cancer better?
Some competitors chose to focus on the social sciences. Zareen Rahman from Brookings, South Dakota, wanted to find a new way to quantify the effects of self-induced stressors.
Then I specifically looked at how teenagers use their cell phones and their computers and how that had a negative effect on their performance in school.
Zareen won seventh place in the competition and will receive $25,000. The Science Talent Search began in 1942. Many finalists have gone on to win even bigger awards, says Intel Foundation's executive director, Wendy Hawkins.
Eight of them have become Nobel laureates. A number have become senior members of the National Institutes of Health, the National Academies of Science. We have MacArthur Genius Awards, and we even have one Academy Award winner for Best Actress.
Since taking over sponsorship of the competition in 1998, the Intel Foundation has gradually increased the awards fund. It reached $1.25 million this year. Hawkins says it is a good investment.
We depend on the next generation of innovators, the people who will design the new devices, the new techniques, the new scientific discoveries, and we need to foster that kind of creativity and innovation.
This year, the top prize went to Eric Chen from San Diego, who received $100,000 for his research about a new class of drugs for better control of influenza during pandemics. The Intel Science Talent Search is the oldest and most prestigious high school science competition in the United States. George Putich, VOA News, Washington.
Do you think you have the right answer to this week's quick quiz? Well, let's find out. A few minutes ago, we asked if you knew what the C in Einstein's famous equation E equals mc squared stood for. Is it A, the speed of light in a vacuum, B, the total mass of the universe, or C, the distance between the Earth and Sun? Well, of course, the correct answer is A, the speed of light in a vacuum. Now, here's how Albert Einstein himself explained his equation.
The equation E is equal mc squared, in which energy...
E, or energy, is equal to m, or mass, times c squared, or the speed of light squared. In other words, energy is equal to mass multiplied by the square of the velocity of light. He said that his equation showed that very small amounts of mass may be converted into a very large amount of energy and vice versa, and that mass and energy were in fact equivalent. Got it? Okay. Thanks for playing along with us on this week's Science World Quick Quiz. We'll have another brain teaser for you again next week.
Thanks for listening to VOA Science, Health, and Technology News Magazine, Science World. Our new webpage and blog can be found at voanews.com/science.
Friday, March 14th, was Albert Einstein's 135th birthday, and next year will mark the 100th anniversary of the 1915 publication of his general theory of relativity. While many of us are familiar with that classic equation E equals mc squared, which was included in his theory of special relativity published in 1905, what did Einstein mean by a theory of relativity, and why are his theories still among the most important in science today? To answer those and other questions, we'll hear from biophysicist and astrophysicist Dr. Jeffrey Bennett. He has also written a number of highly regarded textbooks in astronomy, astrobiology, mathematics, and statistics, as well as other books for children and adults. His latest book is called What is Relativity? An Intuitive Introduction to Einstein's Ideas and Why They Matter. Dr. Bennett joins us for today's one-on-one segment to tell us about Albert Einstein, his famous theories, their role in science, and why they are so important. I've heard so much about Einstein's theory of relativity, but frankly, I'm kind of fuzzy on the word relativity and why there's a theory about it. Can you please explain what this is?
The name relativity comes from the idea that motion is relative. And the way I like to think about that is, imagine, you know, if you're running on a treadmill, the treadmill readout might say you're going 10 kilometers per hour, but you're not actually going anywhere. So what does that mean? That 10 kilometers per hour is your speed relative to that mat on the treadmill, but relative to the room that you're in, your speed is zero. But then you can take it further. Ask if someone was standing on the moon looking at you, how fast would they say you were going? Well, in that case, they would see you moving with Earth's rotation at a speed of around 1,000 or more kilometers per hour, depending on your latitude. So different observers will have different views of your motion, and it's that relativity of motion that gives the theory its name. Now, unfortunately, the real heart of the theory doesn't come from the relative part. That part is actually somewhat obvious to most people. It's the fact that Einstein showed that two things are constant in nature, and that's that the laws of nature are the same for everyone, and that everyone always measures the same speed of light. So I like to talk about that as the absoluteness of the speed of light. So I would have preferred if it had been called the theory of absoluteness, but you can see how it got its name, relativity.
Next year will mark the centennial of Albert Einstein's general theory of relativity, which is the second of two of his theories of relativity. 10 years prior to that, back in 1905, he issued his theory of special relativity. Are these two theories of relativity different from each other? And if so, how?
They're not different from each other in the sense that what Einstein was trying to do in both cases was the same thing. He was trying to find a way of explaining what happens with this idea of relative motion. And he realized that under our ordinary intuition about motion, things get really weird as you start to approach the speed of light. And special relativity gets its name special because it applies to the special case in which we do not deal with the effects of gravity. And so what Einstein found was that it was easier to do the work without worrying about gravity. So that's why special relativity came first. When he wanted to add in gravity, it turned out to be much more difficult, and it took him another 10 years to work out all the details.
What I think is really interesting is how well Einstein's theories have held up. I mean, over the years since he developed these theories, there have been a number of scientists who have been doing their very best to try to disprove them, and so far have been unsuccessful. Why do you think that is?
The theories work really well, and that's kind of an amazing thing. You know, the way science works is you always look for places where the theory might not work quite right so that you can find a better theory that improves upon it. And in fact, that's exactly what Einstein's general theory of relativity did for gravity compared to Newton's earlier theory of gravity. Newton's theory works great for almost all circumstances, but when the gravity gets really strong, it doesn't work perfectly anymore, and that's where Einstein's theory comes in and works better. So people have said, well, where are the holes in Einstein's theory? You know, what are the things it doesn't quite work for? And so far, every time someone's come up with an idea of where it might not work, and then we've gone out and tested it, it's turned out it does work. So as far as why, well, I guess he hit the nail on the head, so to speak. He really did a good job with that theory. There is probably eventually going to be something found that doesn't perfectly work with it, but so far we have not been able to find that.
I understand that Einstein had a problem with quantum physics, and I understand also that there may be a possibility that Einstein's theory may not work on the quantum level.
That's a very good point. So the theory of quantum physics is, in a sense, our theory of how nature works on the very, very small level, whereas general relativity is our theory of how it works on the very, very large level. And both those theories have passed every test that they've been put to date. What we do know, however, is that there are places where they seem to give different answers. And the key place is what we call the singularity of a black hole, so what would be in the center of a black hole. And at that point, quantum mechanics and general relativity say different things should be happening. So they can't both be right. We know that. What we can't do, unfortunately, is figure out a way so far to test which one is right or whether neither of them are right. So that's one of the things that theoretical physicists are working on today, trying to find a way to test new ideas that might bring these two theories together and take away this disagreement that they have at the singularity of a black hole.
Speaking of black holes, I love it that you kick off your book with an imaginary journey into a black hole. Now, every time I think of a black hole, I imagine this huge void in space that sucks in everything. Not even light can get away. Why do you say that black holes don't suck?
Because they don't. So the idea that black holes suck somehow got into popular culture through a combination of different things. But a key thing to remember about what Einstein's general theory of relativity tells us is that it expands the range from Newton's theory over where we can deal with gravity. But it does not give fundamentally different answers from Newton's theory in places where Newton's theory works. And so until you get extremely close to a black hole, at any kind of distance at all, Newton's theory and Einstein's theory will give you the same answers about what's going to happen. And what's going to happen is a black hole is a mass with gravity, and therefore you're going to orbit it. If the sun were to suddenly turn into a black hole, as long as its mass did not change, Earth's orbit would not change. The black hole does not suck things in. And in fact, black holes physically are fairly small, even though they're very large in mass. You'd have to try really hard to fall into a black hole. You have to aim right at it. Otherwise, you're just going to be slung around it by its gravity, just like a spacecraft going around Jupiter.
That was biophysicist, astrophysicist, and author Dr. Jeffrey Bennett. His latest book is called What is Relativity? An intuitive introduction to Einstein's ideas and why they matter. The book is published by Columbia University Press. That's it for this edition of Science World. Before we go, we'd like to invite you to visit our new website and blog. The address is voanews.com/science. Along with program information, you'll find stories, links, and much more. Science World has been produced by Bob Doty, and I am Rick Pantaleo. Be sure to join us next Saturday and Sunday as we check out the latest in science, health, and technology on Science World.